This is tape number 7 of Goblinhood Satyricon. Copyright 1995 by James Beatty. Read by Goblinhood. I'm not sure what chapter this is. It's 23 or 24 or something. It's shortly after the end of St. Cloud's world. And yet, Goblinhood presented this to his audience and to me as a public service, a gesture of civic-spirited philanthropy in the age of AIDS. And at that, he did try to make it as educational as he could manage. But even this smacked somewhat of a St. Cloudian outlook, to say nothing about delusions of grandeur, let alone a variation of St. Cloud's puerile exhibitionism. And me? I was so fixated on the question of whether he could actually get this junk on the tube, or even get away with it in a public gallery, that I overlooked all indications of his growing obsession. As it turned out, the public access station successfully broadcast the sex demo, but perhaps significantly developed mechanical failure when it came to lynching Columbus. One way in which G.H. managed to browbeat me into letting him go through with this was by persuading me to buy him an inflatable sex doll to facilitate the sex performance, just in case we decided to include it. An expenditure of 30 pieces of silver, paper actually, that I could ill afford. Cleverly, he deduced that I'd never let an expensive prop like that go to waste, no matter how much I wanted to chicken out. By showtime, of course, it had evolved beyond the lowly status of a mere prop, and G.H. was more or less blatantly weaving it into a St. Cloudian type of mythology. For that matter, Goblinhood's script even alluded to one of St. Cloud's greatest fears by referencing the story, The Testament of Magdalen Blair. In this yarn by Aleister Crowley, a man dies, begins to rot, and is cremated, but remains conscious and aware throughout, as reported to us by the telepathic narrator. Even after cremation, the man's mind lived on in horror, and this, suggests Crowley, is what death is. For whatever difference it makes, G.H. dragged this into the satanic Ameriflora because it turned out that tobacco smoke was the only way to block the awful telepathic impressions haunting the narrator. At any rate, St. Cloud once wrote a sequel to Crowley's tale, in which the dead mind goes insane and begins to imagine things, like light, a perfect garden, that kind of thing. The deranged sentience even dreams up a pair of hapless hominids, begins torturing them, and sees that it is good. Well, anyway, there I was with this sex doll, properly named, promptly named Maya by Goblinhood, who claimed that the name meant the veil of illusion that we call reality. And Goblinhood, quite naturally, of course, wanted to test drive it in the true spirit of science or something. And we learned a kind of funny thing. By this time, G.H. was so far gone in his St. Cloudist depravity that he could only have come, by and large, in a woman's asshole. Maya, of course, had a mouth, an asshole, and a cunt, all simply plastic holes containing air-cushioned plastic sleeves. But you'll never guess which fake orifice was the only one G.H. was able to come in. He claimed that this was analogous to the experiment of giving baby chimpanzees dolls to use as surrogate mothers, but I just figured it was analogous to Goblinhood being in even worse shape than I'd ever thought. Not that I'm so down on any form of paraphilia. By itself, it seems harmless enough. My favorite mainstream TV show, the Emmy-winning Picket Fences, once featured a priest with a fetish for women's shoes. When this came out, his parish, amazingly, let him keep his job, which is the kind of thing that attracts me to the show, by skewing it into the realm of fantasy, perhaps. Although he did have to promise to seek help, presumably the help of someone other than God, who seemed to have been out to lunch in regards to this matter. Anyway, ironically, Goblinhood's public tryst with inflatable plastic was very ironic indeed, demonstrating as it did so well the plastic nigh paraphiliac barrier between human organs implicit in safe sex. Goblinhood even demonstrated on Maya the use of plastic dental dams for cunnilingus, and then, not wishing his audience or the folks at home to be unsafely in the dark about anything whatsoever, the prospective presidential candidate turned Maya over and used his plastic dental dam to kiss Maya's plastic ass. 25. Bella Madonna had gone back to simply moaning and writhing as my heated tongue wandered down toward her cloacal septum and stopped just north of the musky semi-pubic forest which started there. "Turn over," I whispered huskily. "Why?" she demanded sulkily. "Because I want to do your ass, but I can't reach it from this angle and still breathe," I explained breathlessly. She flopped over rather quickly and presented me with the perfect pale pillow flesh of her rounded, fatty-cheeked ass, quivering in anticipation. Her plump, dimpled globes fairly gleaming below the border of that tough leather jacket. But my eyes were glued to the big brown dimple in between, buried in a thatch of dark fur. There could be dingleberries buried there too, in all that hair, but I didn't think so. Her bottom looked carefully wiped, almost as if she'd expected me to kiss it all along, as if she thought of me as some kind of suck-ass. But what a chance she was taking, exposing it to me like this, the keys to the kingdom, so to speak. What if I tricked her? What if I only wanted to laugh at her or something, as in, you really expect me to kiss that smelly thing, you fat-ass dimwit? To actually put my mouth anywhere near that ghastly orifice you use for dumping shit out of your body? Get real. I just wanted to see how hairy it was and how carefully you've wiped it lately. Ha ha ha. I win. And it occurred to me as I feasted my eyes to hope that she wasn't utilizing telepathy at this moment and maybe contemplating kicking my nuts to within an inch of their lives. I noticed that the more I hesitated, the more her buttocks began to suddenly, subtly clench like two fists closing ranks to protect Festung asshole from any kind of foul play. What if I tried to fist fuck her while her arse was so conveniently gaping at me like that? Then where would she be? And where would my nuts be if she heard me thinking such things? But I didn't want her to get too worried while I was savoring this moment, so I softly touched her now stony cheeks with my fingertips, and I placed my mouth over the little V shape at the top of her deep butt cleavage as my tongue lightly flicked the canyon itself. She began to relax again, slowly, dreamily. I spread her open. Suddenly her flesh seemed to swim before my eyes as a new wave of ichor disorientation swept over the shores of my mind. For an instant, I felt alone in the universe, rapidly dissolving into a reeking puddle on the floor of an empty, unstable room. Closing my eyes briefly, I could only hope it would pass, that I could hold on to some kind of solid reality. She gasped as I squeezed her nether cheeks reflexively. Perhaps I was lucky that her rectum didn't gasp as well, as I tried to hold on while reeling in my momentary dislocation. It was the firm reality of her that brought me out of it with opened eyes. Slowly I focused on the brown island where the treasure was buried. I leaned close and began kissing her ass cheeks with a half-licking, half-sucking technique. She lay very still, perhaps still unsure of my ultimate intentions as I drunk on the succulent flesh of her soft butt, began to very slowly spiral my way downhill toward gamier, far more intoxicating meat. Oh goddess, I adore you, I murmured, flicking the very tips of her anal hairs with the very tip of my tongue. An almost non-existent brush between sips in the night. She tensed minutely, and it thrilled me to see her hungry bottom respond to so light a touch? I let my tongue drift slowly through the hair as if that were as close as I meant to get. I was glad she'd left the light on as I studied her withered brown rosebud and tongued its hirsute halo in a feathery kind of way. I hesitated again, knowing that she'd wonder if she smelled or tasted bad down there, almost feeling her start to blush with embarrassment. Little could she know, unless she was into this too, from my end, that whatever her actual smell was rendered into an addictive, heady perfume by my lust itself, perhaps chemically transmuted in my brain or something. Indeed, this weird semi-biological adjustment during these proceedings creates a large part of the intense fascination which this act holds for me. Most people's assholes I wouldn't have wanted to even look at, much less mingle with intimately, and yet hers now, her puckered anus, was looking like the most inviting square inch or so of anything in the universe. Suddenly I had to really taste her. I delicately touched the uttermost tip of my tongue to the wrinkled wasteland surrounding her now very gradually expanding event horizon. Her tiny shithole twitched like a spider as I firmly touched down on the rim with some of my taste buds. And like certain animals, spiders included, her opening seemed to expand in as impressive a fashion as possible, like a cat puffing itself up just before a fight. The fragrance of it increased a little. It didn't smell of bowel, but of privacy, of intimacy, of her personal essence. And suddenly I thrust as much of my tongue into her rectum as I could physically cram in there. This time she really gasped, and she could have farted directly into my mouth for all I cared. I might not even have known it. Oblivious to the possibility, I yanked her now flaccid cheeks as widely apart as I could, so as to get my tongue even further in, growling and panting. She began thrusting back and forth, grinding her ass into my face, fucking her own anus on my rigid tongue. From inside she tasted of salt, sweat, some kind of clammy, vaginal-type oil, mushrooms, rotting orchids, and just a bitter dash of sewage. And the perfume of her, I wanted to stick my whole face in there as far as it would go. Her formerly tight shithole had sphinctered into a huge gaping cavern, and she tasted like the earth itself in there. Yeah, Shub-Niggurath, the black coat of the woods with a thousand young, she raved. Fungly Nigel-Nath, Cthulhu, Rilia, Nigga, nigga. Fatan. Atlak. Naka. Great Mother. Dream Weaver. The Builder Beneath. Yah. Yah. Yai. Nig. Nigga. Yog-Sothoth. He. Geb, Fi, Throat Dog, Ua, Nyarlathotep, Mighty Messenger, The Three-Lobed Burning Eye, Ogfrod, Ife, Gebelhi, Yog-Sothoth, Nga, Ng, I, Zro. She was gibbering Lovecraftian weirdness in a walking dead language. I was still cleaning her kitchen, licking the bowl, going around the world. She was raising the dead and laying them again, starting at the dragon's head and ending at the dragon's tail. And my own dragon had been awakened and raised into quivering, rampant attention at the bittersweet taste of her tail. I jabbed my tongue rapidly in and out of her now, flexing anus. Just tell him it makes its own gravy, I thought sarcastically, dimly wondering where I'd heard that before. Magna Mater, Magna Mater, Atis, Dia, Ag Hates, Ag Eodon, Agus, Baz, Dunak Ort, Donas, Dolas, Ort, Agus, Leet, Sal, Ungle, Ungle, Re-ch-ch-ch, she intoned and finished by rasping out, Org, Regu, Ack. I had to laugh, even with my mouth glued to her pretty fart gate. That first bit was Lovecraftian cannibal talk, but the last three words were Martian, according to the tabloid Weekly World News from February 19th, 1991. In that earth-shattering issue, above the screaming headline, "The Face on Mars is Trying to Talk," were actual time-lapse-type photographs of the Cydonian desert sphinx with its enigmatic mouth dilating like a gaping, lusting, enigmatic asshole. The lips actually move, say stunned scientists, according to correspondent and dedicated news hound Ken Bassett. That's right, Bassett. Unfortunately, all the stunned scientists could make out were the words Org, Rigu, Ak. And now here was Bella Madonna purring those words continuously, ecstatically, as my own face accomplished kind of an ongoing cerebral orgasm into her dirtiest, most private, possibly most sensitive bodily area. Our flesh seemed to dissolve together, timelessly, as I heard her breathlessly whispering the following magic words. You can fuck me there if you want. 26. Unfortunately, for all its St. Cloudian idealism, Goblin Hood's sexual debut on TV wasn't without its minor sexual, its minor technical glitches. By that time, Maya was popping her valve right in front of the audience and having to be taped shut. Goblin Hood actually thought of Maya as her. No quantum leap, surely, from thinking of the other renegade clubbers as them. His biggest worry, though, was the fear of getting erect beneath his lugubrious black loincloth after carefully obscuring the size of his, our, penis with comments like, "Hung like a horse." Actually hung like Eohippus, those tiny horses of yesteryear. Still, he kept his cool pretty well, even throwing down the St. Cloudian gauntlet by claiming to worship Maya, which was quite true in a way. To demonstrate the use of condoms, he belted a small butt plug onto Maya's inflated loins and deployed the condom there. Then he pretended to get it jammed up his own ass from Maya as a public service for the gallery audience and for the folks at home. He mentioned masturbation in connection with this, though he already knew what they'd wind up concluding years later on the paraphiliac episode of Picket Fences. They concluded that spanking the monkey, or milking the lizard, as they called it, was okay, but that one shouldn't expect a standing ovation for it. Meanwhile, was it Mark Twain, Hemingway, who once proclaimed that it would never be a paying spectator sport? Later that year, as the election approached, Goblin had decided to spice up his campaign with an even grislier exhibition, which, alas, never quite made it to television. This time he dropped the see-through plastic pants, but wore a wet plastic zippered genital pouch beneath his loincloth, and even his asshole was sheltered beneath the quarter-inch wide elastic string bisecting his hairy cheeks. He looked like Piltdown Man on a bad-ass day. This time he'd built a life-size dummy of me and accused us of having sex together. I was his campaign manager. To demonstrate, he dressed Maya as himself, belted dildo included, though this was actually Maya too. The original Maya, to Goblin Hood's intense grief, had long since stopped being inflatable, and even this one had sadly sprung a leak. It was like the slow death of a more or less renewable god. And so even Maya II, alias Goblin Hood, was rapidly deflating as he plugged a long vibrator minus batteries. As he plucked a long vibrator, minus batteries, from the crotch of my dummy and started jamming it in and out of Maya's shrinking butt. Strangely, this was during a long episode entitled Odalisk 911, in which Goblin Hood was juxtaposing this sleazy sex act with the death of my mother for some crazed reason of his own. In the end, he rapidly jacked off Maya's pathetic little butt plug with her plastic ass stuffed with plastic cock, tore up a cardboard automobile, and symbolized Maya's orgasm by squirting almost a whole tube of Vaseline into a filthy jizz rag. Then he smoked a cigarette. Some fun, eh? And yet, amazingly, this tasteless scene was supposedly the artistic high water mark around which G.H. based this entire performance, which was otherwise a psionic confession concerning the Martian Provisional Government, hoping, of course, to garner votes. And he might have won the election, too, if space aliens hadn't endorsed the Democrat candidate on the cover of Weekly World News, August 11th, 1992. Instead, G.H. lost by a handful of ill-advised votes, resulting in another fine mess that space aliens and the Weekly World News had gotten us all into. Or as the space aliens like to say, Org Rigu Ak. 27. Following Bella Madonna's tremulous announcement, I languidly removed my tongue from her dirt road with, inadvertently, a slight slurping, farting noise, born no doubt of suction by that time. She tensed minutely and coughed and moaned as if not knowing for sure what the noise was, but trying to cover it up anyway. Amused, I fondly stroked her magnificent quivering buns and watched her gaping orifice contract almost instantaneously, like a confused photon, to a hole the size of a pencil tip, wrinkled and brown and writhing in my furring vision like a collapsing wolf spider with a black swastika tattooed on its belly. I noticed a jar of lubricant sitting nearby and opened it. For a moment, my bleary thoughts turned to pragmatic considerations. As if reading my mind, or at least scanning my uppermost concerns, she murmured, "Don't worry about rubbers. We have other protections here." A pleasant aspect of being here, I decided, as I touched the very tip of my well-lubricated, empurpled, fully engorged and throbbing prick to the tiny black swastika at the dead center of the twitching brown spider described by the coarse hairs, which represented a much wider anal circumference. She softly began to open to me, like a flower opening to the sun. Suddenly she widened and sucked me all the way into her with a quiet farting noise that we both coughed to cover up this time. I could almost smell her that way, the shadow of a rich brown smell, though all of her cheeks were now turning red. My prick seemed to swell even more rigidly erect. I filled her as the soft flesh of her bottom quivered against my groin. I could feel my scrotum slapping against her twat. She uttered a choked cry and began slowly sliding back and forth upon me as I held myself stiff, braced on my knees, my hands lightly clutching her fat, yielding buttocks. I saw greasy smears of shit staining my cock as she rubbed herself on me, and I could even smell it faintly, as though far away in very cold morning air. "Spank me," she squealed, clutching her throbbing clit between two fingers. I growled and slapped angry red welts onto her flopping, pallid cheeks as she humped my dick even harder. "Fuck me," she screamed. "Harder! Hard faster!" I snarled inarticulately, pinching her flabby buns as I began jackhammering my boner into and all the way out of and back into her totally yielding turd tunnel like greased shit as she moaned in a high-pitched voice, jacking herself off with complete abandon. I almost screamed just at the exquisite sight of her creamy, defenseless, quaking bottom getting cornholed beneath the rugged exterior of that nail-studded leather jacket. "Oh God, butt-fuck the living shit out of me," she croaked as I began to pop my clutch in her chocolate speedway, raving inarticulately, my hands clutching the air spasmodically. I seemed to fall into eternity, into the essence of God, as I started coming into her gaping shit tube. Suddenly she clenched me with that nether muscle, and I came again, ejaculating almost against my will as she enclosed me with iron force, and the ichor began to penetrate my vast orgasm. But her contracting anus seemed to grow both tighter and redder, as well as huger and darker, and with no further warning than that, in the blink of an eye, I found my still turgid sword sheathed dead center in a bright red hourglass shape, a shape surrounded by a huge, hairy, shiny black widow spider, chittering and clicking orgasmically, all eight eyes glazed. Good Lord, what the fuck was she doing? What was the ichor doing? And what in the name of hell was I doing? Fucking a giant spider. And how could it feel so good? I gasped in horror as I felt myself start to spurt semen into her mysterious guts yet once again, just before I mercifully passed out. 28. Of course, Goblinhood, ever one to hedge his bets, had taken the precaution of threatening during a showcase routine in front of the National Performance Network at Stash's on High Street, October 26, 1992, while the NPN was convening in Columbus, to bypass the election and to rule quietly from behind the scenes via psionic manipulation by order of the Martian Provisional Government. but his heart wasn't really in it. He was still grieving for the original Maya, whose plastic body could no longer hold air. But one disturbed day, like the taxidermist maniac created by Robert Bloch and Alfred Hitchcock in the film Psycho, or like the egregious 50s necrophiliac monster Ed Gein, whose exploits may have inspired the Texas Chainsaw Massacre, T.H. came up with the swell brainstorm of stuffing Maya 1 with plastic bags. She looked pretty lumpy and decrepit that way, and her size 30 asshole was no fun to fuck anymore. But Goblinhood was comforted to have her back around anyway. He'd sort of fallen in love with her. And then the true inspiration struck with the force of a devastating mind quake. Number 30 on the Spectre scale. One day as GH was playing with that batteryless vibrator and idly staring at the doll's open mouth, the Zarathustra music from the film 2001 began booming in his mind as Goblinhood excitedly ascertained that the long plastic dildo just fit quite snugly in Maya's mouth, pointed upward like a perverse obelisk. Oddly, the mouth of the second, supposedly identical doll was just a fraction too loose to hold the thing effectively. Coincidence or divine providence? And so began a bold new phase of their torrid love affair, a phase which one could only imagine had not G.H. taken the trouble to position mirrors so that he could watch the action while Maya was screwing his ass, and had he not troubled to add his own life drawings, self-portraits this time, to St. Cloud's lineup, thus coming closer than ever to some kind of unity with the anonymous models in St. Cloud's porn that Goblinhood, too, was half-reverencing by this time. Only this time, I put my foot down absolutely when he wanted to bring this zesty tableau to the performance stage, and after our bitterest disagreement ever, during which I tried fairly to weigh freedom of expression against the fact of harsh realities, legal and otherwise, we finally compromised on him drawing the aforementioned pictures and continuing St. Cloud's book, which is yet another fine mess. You'll doubtless agree that good old St. Cloud has gotten us into. All in fun, of course. And when I came to in Sodom, Goblinhood was copulating with Bella Madonna, who at least looked humanoid again. She was wearing a monstrous dildo, firmly attached, and he was letting her jam it violently in and out of his aching butt. His rigid cock was throbbing with every stroke, and she was growling something about fucking the shit right out of his ass and making him eat it while she slashed his stinging buns with a thin wooden switch. I passed out again just as some just as cum started spurting from his rod, while her greased spike drove relentlessly, screamingly home. A real party animal, that scalawag goblin hood. 30. I awoke alone. Even G.H. was gone, though a bitter, earthy taste in my mouth made me wonder if she carried out her threat, if, in fact, G.H. had even reminded her of it, and, who knows, perhaps clamored for more. People, even people like Goblin Hood, will do strange things in the embrace of religious ecstasy. Still, I wondered what had become of the erstwhile Black Widow. As my memory filtered back and my gorge began to rise, I had to find a bathroom quick. Suddenly, racked with excruciating pain, I seemed to void the contents of both stomach and bowels, as well as copious quantities of blood, onto her expensive-looking spider-patterned carpet. I closed my eyes, half-choked on bloody vomit. But when I recovered from my exhausted spasm, I could find nothing to clean up. It must have been the ichor fucking with my head. What was really going on? I became sure of one thing as I sat naked on her floor, shivering with arachnophobic dread. Good sex or no, I had to get out of here. I didn't want to spend the rest of my life fucking spiders. Not even giant spiders who sometimes doubled as attractive women. If I'd wanted to fuck animals, I'd have gone to the fabled sister city of Gomorrah. That was what went on there, or so I'd heard. For that matter, it suddenly struck me as odd that that city hadn't appeared in any of Bella's map-like etchings. Well, who cares, I thought. My problem now is to flee precipitously. How'd I get here, anyway? I'd gotten here by bus, I then remembered. By magic bus, as near as I could figure it. Maybe by combining magic with psionics and by wishing really hard, I could escape the same way before the Black Widow came back to devour me. And what do you know? When I opened my eyes again, I was miles and years away, if not light years, which seemed more likely. It was like starting out all over again, except that this time I didn't have to register for any kind of death lottery. I felt I was probably doomed anyway, if only because of the ichor. I was even nauseous again, and felt like I hadn't slept in years again. Fortunately, too, I was also fully clothed again. But where exactly was I? I glanced furtively about, with a jaundiced eye at a jaundiced scene. I was standing in a long line of ramshackle, sad-assed people in a decrepit but bus terminal. It was either late night or very early morning. I had my ticket in my hand, my duffel bag and other luggage at my feet. I suddenly recognized the bus station as the one in San Francisco. Glancing at my ticket, I saw that I was bound for the Midwest, and now I even realized when this was. In September of 1986, right after the Nurgle episode began, I'd attempted to flee from I knew not what to the West Coast for the third time in my life. The first time in 1971, I'd been scared by spiders during an acid trip. No, really. and had flown, for some reason, to Los Angeles to live, even planning to try and go to school there. But after a week of exploring and of watching 10th run films in all-night theaters in downtown LA, I'd returned, defeated, on a Greyhound bus. This for economic reasons. Ironically, I picked up a copy of Kurt Vonnegut Jr.'s classic, God Bless You, Mr. Rosewater, at the LA terminal and read it on the long ride home, which proved immensely formative. And thus, anyway, was established a pattern for these episodes. Fly out like a butterfly, crawl back like a worm. Nor could this retrograde metamorphosis ever be reversed, because while I didn't really like flying, nothing but sheer aching necessity could get me on a cross-country bus for that distance. The next time I tried this was at least founded upon more positive motives. In 1973, after meeting a famous underground cartoonist, Justin Green, author of the immortal Binky Brown Meets the Holy Virgin Mary, at a college seminar, I'd flown to San Francisco on borrowed money, hoping to become an underground cartoonist myself. St. Cloud would have approved of their sexual obsessiveness anyway. My prospects were symbolized by the words of S. Clay Wilson, another big-time comics artist, one of the best, actually, when I met him. "So you came out here to stick your harpoon in a dead whale?" Yeah, well, at least I'd held out for a month at that time, living in a seedy hotel on Market Street before fleeing home on a bus. This time, 13 years later, I'd flown out to get away from the ruins of my life and from the consequences of my Martian adventurism, though I didn't yet realize that at the time. But by now, San Francisco had changed, or so it seemed. Changed, perhaps, from a tourist trap into a tourist trap, or something. My old digs on Market Street were full up now on a perennial basis. I dragged my stuff around town for hours, looking for another cheap hotel. Finally, I found a sleazy place for retired pensioners halfway up a steep hill, and paid for a week in advance for a tiny room where I wasn't even allowed to smoke. When I went out to eat, people were lying bleeding in the gutter near the homeless shelter just down the street, and I mean down. Worst of all, though, I began experiencing acute homesickness in almost the Lovecraftian sense, he having been famous for his inability to live anywhere other than Providence, Rhode Island, which was surely an ironic mindset for an interdimensional wanderer, though it might have helped me explain my late panic in Sodom. At any rate, it was so unlivable there for me that in less than a week here, I was again having forfeited the rest of my non-refundable rent, waiting to hop a bus for the hellish ride home, about five times worse to my mind than riding a bus to New York and back from Ohio, which I'd also done at some point. I didn't throw up this time waiting for the bus, maybe because I was older and wiser by now. But most of the people in line looked at me like I was covered in puke anyway. Hell, they should have seen themselves. The bus ride was uneventful until we reached the Nevada-Utah border. There, I remember about 20 of us standing in the hot afternoon sun outside the bus, like a pack of smokers beside a desert casino, frantically chain smoking before we got back aboard. Utah didn't permit smoking on Greyhounds and even had plainclothes cops riding around on them to enforce it. En route to Salt Lake City, a young Canadian tourist sitting beside me struck up a conversation. He was killing a bottle of whiskey while I sat there, dying for a smoke. He told me the strangest thing about America to him, pay toilets, which he claimed were unknown in Canada. I had to admit that the concept was pretty strange. But an even stranger thing happened to me in Salt Lake City. I was waiting to change buses in their terminal, a much nicer one than San Francisco's. It was an hour-long wait, and my nerves were on edge as I smoked enough cigarettes for the next 3 hours. Suddenly, disaster seemed to strike as my name was called, and typically mispronounced, over a loudspeaker. I was to report to somewhere or other for reasons unknown. It must be about my luggage, I thought, and froze. My luggage contained all of Goblin Hood's St. Cloud memorabilia, including the drawings and the pornography which had inspired them. The Utah authorities had probably ascertained this by means of a pornography detector or of porn-sniffing dogs. Oh, Christ, I thought, truly sickened now. They probably hang pornography buffs around here. And for carrying it across state lines, no telling what a state would do that didn't even allow smoking on its interstate buses. But there was nothing for it but to face the music. I could never escape Utah on foot, and certain recent experiences had made me unwilling to try bailing out into some other dimension. I reported to the information desk and, sure enough, was led to the baggage area. There were my bags, containing, among other things, Goblin Hood, who was never around, it seemed, when I really needed him, and whose crime this really was, though he wouldn't be the one to get drawn and quartered for it. I wound up facing an obviously undercover baggage clerk, a young black man, soft-spoken and friendly enough, a good disguise, I figured, waiting for him to put the cuffs on me. "It's about your luggage," he said. "How come you want it to go to Memphis when you're going to Ohio?" He held a baggage claim ticket in his hand. "Huh?" I gaped. "Let me see that." Sure enough, my hastily scrawled Columbus did somehow look like Memphis, but I had the eeriest damned feeling that this guy didn't mean Memphis, Tennessee, circa 1986, but rather Memphis, Egypt, circa ancient times. In any case, I thought I was going to faint with sheer relief. I leaned back against the wall for a minute to catch my breath. I closed my eyes and opened them back again, back in Bella Madonna's apartment. I was still lying naked on the floor. I could hear female voices approaching from the hallway, probably the rest of the Black Widows, zeroing in for the kill. Too late now for escape. I could never get away on foot. The Utah-Memphis episode hadn't apparently had anything to do with anything, other than the fact that it had, once upon a time, actually happened. But now it was years later and universes away. With a sense of tired resignation, I faced the door as the Black Widows walked in. There were five of them, including Bella Madonna, with certain minor personal touches as variations. They all looked exactly the same. "Clones!" I exclaimed, striking my forehead with like a real dumbbell. "Why didn't I ever think of that?" 31. And maybe they were clones, for all I ever found out. Or maybe they were quintuplets. Or maybe they were just another I-Corps-induced hallucination. I never knew for sure. The Black Widows all wore the same mask and the same leather and fishnet ensemble. Their crotches turned out to all have the same hourglass-shaped pubic hair formation, and they all, like Bella Madonna, had what sounded like made-up names: Mary Jane, Lady Lucidity, and Dreamweaver. The fifth one, though, claimed to be using her real name: "I carry a whore." But the others just called her Ike. Oddly, five of these strange telepaths seemed less threatening to me than one of them, as if they could be expected to exercise some sort of restraining influence on each other. Actually, mobs work exactly the other way around, tending to disinhibit one another. In any case, they still seemed foreboding enough that I figured I'd never leave here alive. Not that I really cared that much anymore. Everything seemed to be crawling with I-Corps-induced spider hallucinations. Even the clock's hands pointed to spiders, though the women, thankfully, still seemed human. Besides, everywhere else there was for me to go was seeming more and more like Utah to me, and I decided to try and enjoy the prospective encounter, whether I survived it or not. But it turned out to be goblinhood that they wanted to party with. They were fascinated with the concept of St. Cloudianity and wanted to know more than Bella M. had picked up at random from his thoughts. "In addition," she told me, "I found out about his performance ambitions, and I think you're being really unfair not to let him fulfill them. After all, we're an audience and we'd love to see the show." They all laughed. And so, after I located the mask where I'd left it on her floor, it turned out to be goblinhood time again. And Bella had even gotten a bunch of plastic bags together so that GH could restop Maya, who was then treated to a set of official Black Widow's regalia, though he left her mask off to avoid getting it all mucked up with lubricant or whatever. Then the plastic vibrator was broken out and prepared by soaking it in very hot water. They even provided mirrors in front and back so that GH could watch the action as well. A spotlight was trained on the masked buffoon, while Bella Madonna projected images of St. Cloud's sacramental bimbos on the wall in front of him, and he performed quite well. The routine was like some kind of psychosexual rodeo as he rode Maya's stiff tongue like it was some kind of bucking bronco, and the female audience stimulated him immensely as he glanced at St. Cloud's corn porn spread around him on the floor and jacked himself off into a thunderous climax, cum erupting from his swollen crank like lava from Vesuvius. When it was over, they applauded wildly. They even gave him a standing ovation. Their biggest kick, unknown to him at the time, had been in reading his mind, which, in true St. Cloudian style, had been dutifully focused on the corn porn models, savoring their visual aspects and trying to imagine their thoughts, while he finally became one of them, in fact, a professional asshole. And while the Black Widows listened directly in on his steamy thoughts, playing with themselves all the while. In other words, his presentation was the hit of the season with a bullet. Afterwards, the masked catamite sat on Maya's jizz rag shrouded chest, not wanting to sit with his greasy ass on Bella's nice clean carpet, and smoked a cigarette while the widows chattered among themselves about his little command performance. "He's like some kind of weird superhero," gushed Mary Jane. "As in Goblin Hood meets Dr. Dildo, ha ha ha." "No, wait," exclaimed Lady Lucidity. "I can tell you exactly what he's like." She strode confidently to Bella's bookshelf and grabbed a tome entitled The Film Encyclopedia, Science Fiction, edited by Phil Hardy, William Morrow and Company, Inc., 1984. "He's like the Italian movie wrestler, Superago, and his bulletproof leotard, listen, who only makes sense in the context of the Italian popular cinema. Seen in isolation, both the character and his films are simply ridiculous," she read, and the Black Widows all chortled enthusiastically while G.H. tried to figure out what they were talking about. "Hold on," said Ikor, thumbing through the encyclopedia. "Here's a good one. Blue Demon versus the Infernal Brains, 1966. Listen, it's about a mad doctor who kills scientists and other people such as wrestlers, in order to extract the phenomenal intelligence and knowledge from their brains. They are cracked up, and Goblinhood decided a little uneasily that they must be talking about St. Cloud's pretensions to scientific research. Dreamweaver piped up, "I've heard that some of those Mexican movie wrestlers, like Santo, never took their masks off, even when the films started to include obligatory nude scenes. Bet they never included scenes like the one we just saw," guffawed Ikor, to everyone's amusement, with the confused exception of Goblinhood. "If you think that was something," snickered Bella Madonna, "just wait till you see what he can do with his mouth." So that was the way it was going to be, eh? 32. And that was indeed the way it was going to be, except that Goblinhood left all the oral chores to me. His mask turned out to be a little too claustrophobic for such intimacy. Otherwise, he had a swell time during the marathon orgy which followed, punctuated by drugs which kept the action going for 3 full days. He even broke out his Martian Tarot jacket and our hand-painted cards, and treated all the Black Widows to vague and inconclusive tarot readings, which were not, perhaps significantly, identical. On the third day, I sat, totally drained, smoking a joint with Bella Madonna while the others sprawled snoring around the room. My hostess and I were discussing sexual cannibalism. "Do you know who Joseph Campbell was?" she asked me, toking heavily and passing me the roach. "The famous mythologist?" I replied. "Sure, I've even read some of his stuff." "Well, he told Bill Moyers a story on TV one time about some primitive tribe's initiation rites for young men. As I remember it, there was a week or two of weird ordeals for the boys, who were all supposed to be virgins. At the end, they were led to a hut made of sticks which supported a heavy slab of rock. One by one, the boys were sent into the hut, in which was a beautiful woman, also a virgin, I think, who had been selected as a great honor to her. One by one, the boys fucked the woman under that slab and thus became men of the tribe. But the last lad in line was also in for an even greater honor than his peers. While he fucked the woman, the wooden stakes were pulled away. The stone slab fell and crushed the lovers, who supposedly died in ecstasy, and who were then recipients of the greatest honor of all, being ceremonially eaten by the tribe. And it was all supposed to be voluntary, just like the ancient Mayan football players, or whatever they were, who competed during festivals for the privilege of having the winning team's captain get sacrificed on the spot. "So what's your point?" I wondered sleepily. "My point is that the Black Widows actually did eat one of our lovers once upon a time, but it was strictly voluntary. He was suicidally depressed or something, and yet he had the idea that his essence would somehow live happily on through being part of us, which I think is one aspect of primitive religious cannibalism. Did it work? I asked, yawning. We could never tell, laughed Bella Madonna. We never knew him well enough to be sure. But my real point is that only consensual things can happen here for some reason, as if this dimension had been created by someone with a mind like photons speeding away from a light source, who also happened to be infected with your fetish for harmlessness. This whole continuum seems to have been built around geisha concerned with harmless personal liberty. That's why sex with underage children or with animals is impossible here. They're apparently not supposed to be consensual enough. The city of Gomorrah, for instance, doesn't exist here like it did in the Bible. Regarding bestiality, I decided for the umpteenth time not to ask her about that giant spider, figuring it for a visionary ichor side effect of some kind. I yawned again. All the drugs, including the Treazenol she'd recently given me, were wearing off now, and I was thinking only with great difficulty. Does that mean, I groggily inquired, that you clowns will only eat me if I want you to? We'd love to eat you if you were already dead, she replied earnestly, and if we had your permission. But you're a lot more valuable to us alive. Goblinhood is a scream, and you're pretty good yourself with that nasty tongue of yours. Oh, well, I blushed tiredly. She relentlessly continued her praise, quoting from an ad for a woman's hemorrhoid medicine. You are extremely kind, if not downright ecstatic, to a woman's delicate tissues, ha ha ha. Even better than toilet tissue for giving a woman that clean, clear through feeling. She laughed uproariously. Hey, wake up. I blinked drowsily, kind of glad not to have actually heard that last compliment. But all this is sort of germane to the idea of sexual cannibalism, she went on in a semi-learned manner. The ugliest thing about cannibalism is that it so personalizes death in such a strange way. I mean, everybody has to die, right? So technically it doesn't matter what happens to your dead leftover flesh. If not eaten by people, it would be eaten by worms or flames. But though we seldom think about it, and we hardly talk about it at all, most people would rather be eaten by dogs than by people, which is actually an indication of how we all feel about each other. Unless we're passionately in love with whoever's going to eat us, most people wouldn't be thinking of living on through someone else, they'd be too upset at the idea of their own physical essence, their uttermost personal property, perpetuating someone else's life. And worst of all, she concluded, germanely, at last, for a lot of people, is the fact that cannibalism seems to render humans into the ugliest substance imaginable to humans, human excrement. But this is a learned, not an instinctive attitude. I mean, how ugly is the thought of human shit to you when you're trying to stick your tongue as far up a woman's large intestine as it will go? Huh? Yeah, okay, I snapped grumpily and self-consciously, but I sort of saw her point. Hey, she said. I woke up from a still deeper nod. Yeah? I said. We kind of like the idea of worshipping Maya as a goddess or whatever. She seems like a pretty user-friendly supreme being. Will you teach us how to worship her? Hell, that was all based on St. Cloud's delusions, I mumbled. But Bella Madonna wasn't having any. I finally agreed to let Goblinhood become the High Priest of Maya, noting that Bella was already thinking of the doll as her. I nodded out again. Jim, she whispered, shaking me a little. I started fitfully awake, staring wildly. At first, I didn't know where I was, and I wasn't exactly sure who she was, though I was really glad she was there. I'd been momentarily afraid that Bella Madonna was only the stuff that dreams are made of. I'm sorry to keep waking you up, she told me. You really need to get to bed. But I wanted to ask you something that I can't figure out from reading your mind.
Ask away,
I yawned. If you had it to do over again, she began hesitantly, would you still have used psionics to kill your own mother when you were a kid? That is, assuming the psionic element wasn't just some kind of adolescent guilt trip about wanting her death that you blew way out of proportion. I finally answered her. Yes and no, I replied. No, in that if I knew everything I know now and knew I was really psionic, I couldn't have done it. I shudder to think of what she'd say about me if she were alive now. She was a product of the mid-century and of the American Deep South. Nonetheless, I couldn't deliberately kill her. Yet, I wouldn't change what happened, if that's what you're asking, because it was part of a life that made me what I am, which I like, and that, moreover, led me to this moment of being with you, which I really like. She she seemed flattered and happy about my answer, but was still confused on one point. But if you really like being you, where does goblinhood fit into the situation?
He's the best part of me, I confided, yawning lavishly.
He actually stands for something, as weird as that something is, whereas I'm just trying to get through my life. And he's so much easier to be, because he's got so flimsy of a personality. He makes a kind of sense in his own context, even though seen in isolation, he's simply ridiculous. But if only the mask were more comfortable, I wouldn't mind being Goblin Hood all the time. She finally led me to her bed, where she tucked me in and sang a weird lullaby that sounded like a magic spell. I drifted off like a baby and knew no more for a time. 33. I woke feeling more myself than usual, but having had a really weird dream. In my dream, I'd been watching a couple of mice trying to mate on the floor. One of them looked exactly like Senator Ted Kennedy, except for being a fat cartoon mouse with a paunch like a baseball. The female mouse was nondescript, except for being exactly as fat as he was. Oddly, both wore formal evening attire. When they tried to suck face, their roly-poly stomachs bounced off of each other and they had to approach the kiss obliquely. I burst out laughing, and the startled mice heard me and scampered comically into a large crack in the corner of two walls. I discovered that I was small enough to follow them through the opening, and so I did. They were nowhere to be seen, but what was there amazed me. A full-scale alternative room within the wall, obviously unknown to any landlord. An undiscovered country, which I somehow knew even at the time, that I'd dreamed about before. Bella Madonna came in and woke me more fully with a glancing kiss and a cup of steaming coffee. I could smell breakfast cooking and could hear the other Black Widows laughing and bantering in the kitchen. I was glad Bella hadn't really kissed me, figuring that my breath must be horrendous if the taste in my mouth was any indication. I staggered into the bathroom with my Java and took a long, luxurious piss, wondering idly and fussily what had become of Goblin Hood since last night. And then I glanced in the mirror. The warlock saw that a miracle of sorts had transpired in the night. The mask had become his actual face. From now on, he was to be Goblin Hood forever. Part 2. Twilight of the Gob, or Golden Tarantulas. And so it was that Goblin Hood came to live permanently in Sodom with the Black Widows as their high priest of Maya and as their genial mascot and devoted sex object, and also, by the end, as the genial and devoted figurehead of a world state, a theocracy of sorts, revolving around a new world religion called Saint Cloudianity, or simply Mayanism. The religion's Bible was Saint Cloud's book, which Goblinhood had finished for Saint Cloud and had retitled The Cry of the Nocturnal Goatsucker, in honor of Kurt Vonnegut Jr., author of Slapstick. But most folks just called it The Gob's Book. The Gob was the nickname eventually given by everyone to Goblinhood, and, like El Cid, the name or title was virtually untranslatable. And oddly, though this should have been a pretty snazzy period in the Gob's life, he often felt a kind of foreboding, as if the entire world were poised on the brink of some ultimate darkness. His own local situation, moreover, increasingly reminded him of another book, an historical novel by Arthur Kessler called The Gladiators, which even made it into the 59 Collier's Encyclopedia, referenced under Mutiny. Kessler's book revolved around the slave war of 73 BC and the figure of Spartacus. But Kessler, a noted student and critic of totalitarianism, retold everything in terms of the Russian Revolution. In Kessler's version of events, Spartacus set up an ex-slave society for a while, the Sun State, a would-be utopia which turned dystopic almost automatically due to problems surrounding the question of the ends justifying the means. For what it's worth, Kessler's next book, Darkness at Noon, was even more pessimistic. Goblinhood, who loathed power to begin with, had never wanted to be a ruler, much less the nominal pope of an entire world. Under the circumstances, he could only try to avoid the pitfalls of power while also trying to live up to his own persona, personal motto, taken right out of Vonnegut's Slapstick book. If you can do no good, at least do no harm. A quote from Hippocrates.